Good afternoon. This in the right place? Good afternoon. And the time is 3:30 and we have an hour, so I want us to get us started right away. And my name is Joy Charlton. I'm a professor of sociology and also the executive director of the Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility here. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to this session called What I Learned Trying to Save the World. And I will tell you right away that we owe the phrasing of that title to Carolyn Rouse on our panel, who's writing a book with close to that subtitle. So thank you for that. And I am really looking forward to this panel. I'm very interested in what our panelists have to say and what you have to say. It has always seemed to me, and I've been here for quite a while, and that Swarthmore's identity and its history have long reflected a commitment to attending to ways that we can all, in our own ways, help create a world that is more just, more peaceful, and more compassionate. And I'll let our newcomers find their seats. There are seats up here in the corner. So as we are encouraging our current students as well as ourselves to help create an ever more just, peaceful, and compassionate world, we have invited four remarkable alumni to join us on this panel who have themselves been deeply and directly engaged in this work. We've asked them to reflect on their lessons learned and to share their thoughts with us. So let me introduce you to them right away. And I've asked them to sit in chronological order by class year.
Thanks a lot.
But I have a purpose, because one of the things you'll see as they talk is that the world has changed over time. The way that people work with social change has changed over time, and having them talk in this way, I think, will remind us of that and help us think about that automatically as we think about the work that they do. So sitting to our far to the far right is Kevin Quigley, class of 1974. Kevin has devoted much of his professional life to the Peace Corps. In 2012, he returned to Thailand, where he served as a volunteer shortly after Swarthmore, from 1976 to 1979, to now become the Peace Corps Country Director for Thailand. Prior to this move, did I get that wrong?
That's fine. Okay. But I think you can stop there. Yeah, stop there, just save time. That's great.
No.
Yes.
More things about Kevin.
No, let's just move it along. Yeah. Yeah. Save time. We're save time.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I will make it really short, but I can't not let you know these things. He's also served with the president of the National Peace Corps Association, which is for students, it's for individuals whose lives have been affected by the experience with the Peace Corps. And he's also, because this is important, Kevin, he's also served in top executive positions in other organizations that has affected his experience of this work, including the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, the Executive Director of the Global Alliance for Workers and Communities, Vice President of the Asia Society, and Director of Public Policy for the Pew Charitable Trust. That is an abbreviated introduction to Kevin Quigley.
Thank you.
Sitting to Kevin's left is Lourdes Rosado, class of 1985. Lourdes is an attorney. And she is also the associate director of the Juvenile Law Center, a nonprofit organization in Philadelphia dedicated to ensuring that public systems such as child welfare and juvenile justice protect and serve Pennsylvania children. In 2010, Lourdes was named Citizen of the Year by the Philadelphia Inquirer, and for her successful work in what became a highly visible case, seeking to overturn the wrongful convictions of thousands of juveniles in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, because the judges there who tried these young people received more than $1 million in kickbacks from a privately run juvenile detention center. Mm. Yeah. Fortas has also served as a Barrett Fellow in Juvenile Justice at Georgetown University Law Center, where she taught law students and represented youth in the District of Columbia Superior Court. This is also an abbreviated biography of Lourdes. Sitting to Lourdes's left is Carolyn Rouse, class of 1987. Carolyn is an anthropologist. Carolyn is professor of anthropology and Afro-American studies who has taught at Princeton since 2000. She has studied the production of inequality and why people accept the systems that uphold it, focusing on health, religion, education, and development with many publications in all of those fields. Recently, Carolyn's interests have taken her to a small village in Ghana, where since 2006, she has been working toward building a school. The Pan-African Global Academy will be the first high school in its area and is scheduled to open in September. Yes?
No, it's been running for 4 years. Okay. We just graduated our first class.
They just graduated. That's a fabulous update. One of the interesting things about this high school is that its curriculum will focus on material science, agriculture, and engineering, and will emphasize students finding solutions to local problems such as water scarcity, poor drainage, soil erosion, and hunger. And she's currently working on a book entitled Development, Hubris, Adventures in Trying to Save the World.
Cool.
And to Carolyn's left is Nick Martin, class of 2004. Nick is the co-founder and president of Tech Change, the Institute for Technology and Social Change. Tech Change is a DC-based startup that delivers online courses on social change as well as other topics. And to students in over 80 countries and organizations, including the United Nations, the World Bank, and Google. A recent profile in The Economist referred to Tech Change as a team of, quote, socially conscious nerds who came together to further the use of technology for development. And you know, at Swarthmore, we love nerds. We are nerds. And Nick is an educator, technologist, and social entrepreneur with a master's degree in peace education. Prior to founding Tech Change, Nick started an award-winning conflict resolution and technology program for DC elementary schools called DC Peace. You can see we have a remarkable panel of alumni today. They have focused broadly on different issues. They are both global and local. They have worked with different approaches to social change. They've worked at different levels of organizations and with different kinds of organizations. So we have asked them to speak on the topic of what we've learned.
Ah. A light in the dark.
There you go. Yeah. Right. Awesome. I would have done it, with no lights. And so we have asked them to speak way too briefly on their challenges, their surprises, their advice, and we have additionally asked them to think about how their experiences relate to a liberal arts education. After their opening remarks, we'll invite those of you in the audience to ask panelists to address those themes and issues that you are especially interested in hearing more about. So welcome to you, welcome to our panelists, and we'll begin with Kevin Quigley.
Great. Thank you very much, Joy, and thank you all for being here on a beautiful summer day, and it's really a privilege to be here with a great group of fellow Swarthmore alums who are trying in various different ways to change the world. I don't know if it happened to you on the way in, they asked if I was going to film. And so I thought I'd talk about Forrest Gump. So Forrest Gump has this great line, says, I don't know if we have a destiny or if we're just floating around accidental-like on the breeze. And here at Swarthmore, we talk a great deal about life purpose and social benefit. I don't know about many of you. I know for me, I'm still trying to figure it out. So I think I'm the person on the panel who's a floater, I suspect that my fellow panelists have much clearer life trajectories and clearer sense of their destiny. So some of my floating around Forrest Gump-like, you remember Forrest Gump? He taught Elvis how to swivel his hips. He was there when he met Kennedy, there for the Vietnam War. He was there when they developed the smiley face. He helped coin the phrase, shit happens, you know. So Forrest Gump was around the edges of a lot of big events of his time. Similarly, I've been around a lot of the big events of our time. After doing a graduate degree in Irish literature, where I studied change in James Joyce's Ulysses, so there is a thread there. It's sometimes a little opaque, but I became a Peace Corps volunteer, and I saw the debacle of U.S. foreign policy as waves of first Laotian and then Khmer fled genocide in that part of the world. Later, I worked on the sanctions legislation when I did a stint in government that put pressure on the Soviet Union after they crushed Solidarity in the early 80s, and those same sanction tools were used to help undermine apartheid. In the 90s, I did work on a kind of a innovative approach to improve the global workplace, sometimes talked about as sweatshops, or sometimes our economists talk about a global supply chain, but we took a radical approach. Instead of assuming we knew what the problem was, we thought we'd ask. So we did 7,000 one-on-one interviews in four countries and 400 focus groups with the goal of trying to make the global workplace a place of opportunity instead of exploitation for the 95% of young women who work there. And for the last 10 years or so, I've really been looking at trying to find opportunities to expand opportunities for Americans to serve domestically and internationally. Because I know service is the gift that keeps on giving. We all learn through the practice of serving others. Because I'm a liberal arts graduate, they give us instructions about what we're supposed to talk about, but I'm not going to do that. Yeah. Instead of talking about the lessons I learned, and there are things I could say, I think you'll hear it from the others, about you have to be patient and persistent, almost blockheaded. You have to take a chance. You follow your heart. You have to have a sense of humor or humility. Anything worth getting done is probably not going to be done by yourself. You have to involve others. And probably most importantly for me, if you want to change others, if you want to change the world, you have to begin by being able to change yourself. So I wanted to talk more about the process of learning, of how I felt I learned the most, and mention just three quick examples. So a graduate of this place, I think the first lesson for me is you learn the most and you learn the quickest when you put yourself out there. The second lesson is you learn by listening to others. The third, you have to look at things a little differently. So I have three quick little stories to illustrate each of those points. For me, really stretching myself was being a Peace Corps volunteer, 15 kilometers from the Lao border. Like many volunteers, any other volunteers in the room? Thank you for your service. That's great, yeah. I think many of us are trained. I was trained in Thai. I learned about a lot of Thai language. But of course, I was sent to an area where the people are Lao. They speak Lao, they eat Lao, so very typical. So, but for me, I learned a lot of really important things besides learning Thai and Lao. I had studied with Don Swearer here. I had an interest in Theravada Buddhism. I spent time as a Buddhist monk, as I think one of the first Peace Corps volunteers ever to do that. I also learned that I spent my whole time at Swarthmore staying away from the social sciences. I thought they were evil sciences. So I never had a course in political science or in economics. And I learned there that my students, there were enormous equity gaps. So I needed to learn about politics and economics. And it was the era of dependency and center and periphery. And I thought that I needed to get back to the center to try and have some impact on the world. Second little story I want to tell is listening to others. At the spring concert in 2002 that the National Symphony performs on the West Lawn of the Capitol, I was there with my wife, Susan, who's here this afternoon, and she's the font of all my best ideas. And this is right after the tragedy of 9/11, but we had already invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. And Susan looked out at the mall, and if you think of mall as kind of the symbolic center for our country, the place that captures and narrates the evolving American stories, she said, this is all about war and dead presidents. Where is the memory or the commemorative to peace and understanding? Mm-hmm. So after a lot of effort, I'm really pleased that in January of this year, President Obama signed into law the Peace Corps Commemorative Act to honor the values of Peace Corps service and understanding. That's the start of a long process, but at least we were able to move that along. And the third is just saying looking at things differently. I think Peace Corps volunteers, we're great at telling stories. We think that Peace Corps has had the greatest impact on our lives. But in the spring of 2011, after working for almost 5 years on the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps, much like the 150th of the college, we started with some principles. We wanted it to move the work forward, to expand opportunities for Americans to serve and to increase our impact. And I was traveling with another Peace Corps volunteer on the board of the American University of Afghanistan, and we traveled to Herat, and we talked about the big impact that Peace Corps had on our life. And we said, you know, we think there's an untold story about Peace Corps that's the impact on the people who we work with. So we worked together and created an award to honor the impact of the people that we served with. So I'll stop there. I have some thoughts about how some of the lessons you learn through listening to others, putting yourself out there, looking at things differently, are really the core lessons of liberal arts institutions. Thank you very much.
Well,
yes. There are about 10 seats in the front for those of you who are standing and would like to find one. There are four in the front row.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks also for coming in on a beautiful afternoon. It's it's very gratifying to see so many people interested in this topic when you could be outside on the lawn. So I thank you. So Joy had asked us to reflect on our experiences and our work and how they connected back to our education here. And I'm going to pick up on your theme of three, because I happen to have three myself, and talk about my work through those different themes. I mean, I guess the first is that the small can be very mighty. The second is about how the liberal arts gives you a method of inquiry that no other education really can provide, I think. And the third is to be careful not to be too righteous. So on the first one, I think that I work now, I have the privilege of working for a small nonprofit public interest law firm that actually started about 40 years ago by four Temple Law School grads, literally the minute they got their diplomas. They knew nothing about law, knew nothing about the world, but they started this children's rights organization at a time when most people didn't even really think of children having any rights in the world. It was the cusp of the civil rights movement. And there were some good Supreme Court decisions coming down that were really emphasizing how important it was for youth to have the same rights accorded to adults in many ways in juvenile delinquency proceedings. And one of those rights is the right to counsel, and something that has been affirmed by our U.S. Supreme Court more than 50 years ago, that children who are facing charges either in adult or criminal court have the right to counsel. But unfortunately in the United States, it's still not a right that's realized. And it really came home to me and to my organization, I guess, this past decade of work that we've had on a case. We got a call from a mom back in 1999, believe it or not. She was distraught because her young son, he was 12 at the time, had been adjudicated delinquent and sent away to a facility. What was troubling about the case was, first, the child wasn't represented by counsel, and when we got the transcript of the proceedings, literally he pleaded guilty to quite serious charges by the judge just saying, "So, did you do what they said you did?" And the transcript reflects that the child nodded. That was the extent of his guilty plea colloquy. He was no description of what he was accused of doing, no chance to bring witnesses forward, no explanation of his rights and what rights he was waiving. And most importantly, again, there was nobody there, no attorney there to uphold his rights. So we basically, my organization, which does work on behalf of kids in the juvenile justice and child welfare systems, we quickly moved in to appeal his case, and it was a no-brainer. I mean, clearly the judge had violated his constitutional rights by allowing him to go forward without counsel and many other constitutional rights that I can, a laundry list it would take to rattle them off here. But again, without question, the appellate court overturned the conviction and issued an opinion saying that his constitutional rights were violated. The judge was then quoted in the local paper saying, "I'll never do this again. I'll never send kids away without attorneys." So we thought our work was done. We'd gotten a lot of good press. This judge knew he was on notice that he had to make sure that these kids' rights were being respected. Fast forward about 5 years, we got another call from another parent, and that's basically how we get a lot of our cases. We get calls from parents whose children have been hurt in some way. And it was eerily the same. This was another child who was adjudicated delinquent and sent off in shackles for what was charged as a third degree misdemeanor. She had written some nasty things about her assistant principal on her MySpace page. She didn't have any counsel. What was really frightening about this case was the child was an honor student who'd never been in any trouble that we could tell. And she was immediately carted off to a facility, taken out of her home, literally taken out of the courtroom in shackles. And that really raised alarms for us because it was the exact same judge who said he wouldn't do it again. And that sort of brings into my second point about the method of inquiry. We started realizing we needed to do something different than just appealing this judge's decisions because he kept doing the same thing over and over again. So we started looking at statistics, which I didn't do very well at. But we found that luckily here in Pennsylvania, each county has to report to the state its statistics on how its juvenile courts operate. And one of the things that we found out very quickly was that this judge happened to be sending 10 times the number of kids to facilities than any other judicial court in the state, and that his and 50% of the kids who were appearing before him didn't have counsel. So after much inquiry, it turns out we filed some very special work petitions with the state Supreme Court. And as it turned out, the FBI was also investigating him at the same time, and what was revealed was that he and another judge had taken almost $3 million in kickbacks from these private juvenile detention facilities where kids were being sent. Wow. So that set off our odyssey of basically, as Joy mentioned earlier, petitioning, and ultimately were successful in getting the convictions of several thousand children overturned because they appeared before this judge who was basically taking money from the same people who were running the facilities to whom they were locking these kids up in. And so I credit the liberal arts education for giving me the method of inquiry to figure out different ways of approaching this problem and taking on this judge, because it took a few years before we were actually successful. And I think the third thing that I'll end off with, because I'm getting the time card, is what I was saying earlier about don't be careful not to be too righteous. And this is building off of what our keynote speaker said today, because even though I'm a litigator, I do wear other hats as an attorney, and one of them is to try to create programs and policies for children in the juvenile justice and child welfare system. And I often have to work with people who are my adversaries in court, prosecutors, police officers, for example, in order to build programs for kids that will accomplish, for example, getting them diverted from juvenile justice involvement so they don't have records of their involvement in the system. And so you have to be very careful, I think, not to get too righteous, not to think the prosecutor, who I was trained as a young defense attorney to vilify, is in fact a villain, but to find that common area of consensus, take it to build something good, and then move on from there to build even bigger and greater things. So that's my three lessons learned.
Again, I would like to thank you for coming. This is wonderful to see such an engaged group of an engaged audience, an engaged group of change agents. So I'm going to speak from the Academy, since I work in another institution, and I think that some comparison is in order. So a week ago, Princeton had its alumni reunion, and they get bands, and the band allows you to drink as much alcohol as you want. And it's a debauched weekend with what's called a pee raid and people dressing up in orange and black. Very famous dignitaries and politicians and hedge fund managers dress in funny orange and black suits. And that's the weekend, and it's fun. And I come to, I've actually never gotten a wristband, but I hear it's great fun. And I come to Princeton and I walk on the lawn and find a group of people with a sign about divestment, and I go and I sit in a group of and then I walk through the hallway and I see people singing and there's gamelan, and I think this speaks to the differences, right? I mean, maybe you want a wristband, but it speaks to a lot of the differences, and I think that Princeton is a place that allows people to push ideas. So I want to kind of go to, I guess I have to speak to my what I learned. I'm an anthropologist, and I decided to build a school because I was walking around the campus seeing signs up with images, nobody identified in the images, and I'll say it, there are race issues there. There's somebody who's light-skinned and surrounded by a group of brown-skinned people was saying, you know, let's go change the world. We'll change, you know, everyone's smiling and everyone's happy. And there are a lot of assumptions embedded in all of this, and assumptions about, you know, who knows better what to do, who's the change agent, who has capacity, who doesn't, who's bringing it, who doesn't, what values matter, what don't. And I felt, you know, this movement was growing larger and larger, and it was also connecting to questions about sustainability and development. And connecting to this what's called evidence-based development. And as an anthropologist, I think that I'm going to give you an honorary degree, Kevin. Everything he said is what anthropologists do. That's how we approach everything we study, which is to, you know, dive in, participant observation, ask a lot of questions, right? And don't assume that you know better. And so I decided I was going to do that. I was going to put myself at risk and start a school. And actually, I got a lot of flack from both the quantitative social scientists as well as the qualitative. What are you doing? You know, the quantitative were saying, well, what are your controls? And, you know, how are you going to measure? And what are your, you know? And then the qualitative were saying, how dare you participate in this evil development enterprise? So I got it from both sides. And you know, lo and behold, I go to this wonderful community, and it's actually in the capital of Accra. It's on the western edge. It's in a fishing village, and they say, you know, we've wanted a school for years, and they showed me their urban plan, and here was where the school should be, and we'll give you an indenture for the land. And I come back. I hire these researchers from Ghana. They're brilliant. They do all of these household surveys so that we kind of get a sense of what people want, what this school would be, and if I built this high school for them. So we come prepared for this, and we get a lawyer, and he finds out that, well, the chief sold this land to a returnee, and he'll destroy our school if we build anything on it. So the first thing I have to do is buy the land back for the school to build a school they asked me to build. Fascinating. So then we're about to, we get all the earth movers, and the community goes around and they hold hands and they block the bulldozers and they say, you don't get to do anything until you pay us for this land. So I've gotten an indenture, I've paid for the land through the, gotten lands, you know, claims on it, land claims through the Lands Commission, and now I'm being asked to pay individuals on top of it. In the meantime, the community breaks out in communal violence. It lasts 12 hours. It's a community of 1,500 people. Three people are killed, and people are macheted. 20% of the houses are destroyed. And I had to fire the project manager, the one person who really connected me, because I thought she had built a school. You know, it turns out that somebody else had done that. So I was in a country building a school in a community that didn't really have the land, buying the land twice, and dealing with community violence. So it was, yeah, I put myself at risk. And I learned a lot. And so the takeaway, because I have no time, the takeaway is that none of what I experienced really matters to me understanding what actually happened. What happened preceded me. All of these things were in place before I got there. There are issues with land, post-coloniality. There are issues with law. There's a bifurcated legal system. There's so much social disruption and change. The land I purchased for $15,000 is worth $300,000 now because of the speculative real estate market, the international speculative real estate market. And all of this is a product of, neoliberalism. And the idea that we know how foreign direct investment's gonna change the world, and all it's doing is creating vast social inequality and vast social disruption in Ghana. So really my takeaway is that development, we don't need more innovation. What people need is stability. They need laws. They need laws that they can count on. And that we need to take more time to ask better questions. And not, the quantification doesn't work, because it doesn't work if people don't have the same commitments, the same values. A cost-benefit analysis requires everyone to believe that the costs are the same and the benefits can be, you know, or understood in the same way. So that's, for brevity's sake, I'll leave it there, but that's my.
All right, great. Well, it's a lot of pressure here to go last, but I will do the best I can. Great to be back on campus and hear these incredible stories of social change careers. I have really fond memories of being here. I was a volunteer EMT for a few years, played lacrosse for a year, was the founding member of a band called Over the Influence. We were the biggest band on campus, not in terms of popularity, but in terms of size. We had more members than anybody else, and I think there are a few people here from the band in the audience. So, also worth noting, my freshman year roommate, Mark Annis, from Warden AB First, is still my current housemate. Kudos to Mert Westfall for pairing us up, so that was really, really great. So I graduated in 2004 with degrees in English literature and education with a focus on modern poetry. And I've spent the last 10 years of my life trying to start various types of organizations. Started a nonprofit dedicated to peace building in DC elementary schools, and ran out of money. And then about 4 years ago, started a social enterprise called Tech Change. And as Joy mentioned, we build online courses in social change, things like how to use a mobile phone for public health. We also build software to deliver these courses to all corners of the world. So I've made a ton of mistakes along the way and learned a tremendous amount. And I thought I'd really focus my remarks again on the theme of three, on what I learned trying to start a company with a liberal arts degree. a company that cares just as much, if not more, about social impact and social change than it does about profit. So the first lesson, and we heard a little bit in Kevin's talk, who you work with really matters. So it's impossible to start a company by yourself. And it's so important because of that to find people who share your values, who have the patience to join you on a crazy journey, but who also don't bring the same skills you do to the table. When I started Tech Change, I was just grateful to work with anybody who wanted to work with me. There was no discrimination. But over time, it was so important for us as a team to really figure out and be intentional about the types of people who we brought on to our team to build a really diverse group. So one of the litmus tests we use to hire folks that I really like is, would this person have fit in at Swarthmore College? Would they have been able to keep up with the workload? Would they have been able to creatively contribute to the community? And do they care about improving the world in some way? And we've had a few folks, I'll just highlight a couple here. Will, our CTO, went to Tufts, we don't hold it against him, is one of the most talented computer programmers I've ever met, also happens to be fluent in Chinese, lived in China for many years. One of the trips he came back from China on, decided to run the Boston Marathon 4 hours after the plane landed. Definitely a Swati, right? Also, Sweta works on our instructional design team. She taught special ed in inner city Baltimore, grew up with two parents as math professors, and an incredible rock climber. Definitely also someone who could fit in at Swarthmore. But we don't just hire folks who would have fit in at Swarthmore, we have also hired actual Swatties. So last summer, a quick story, I got an email from a mutual friend asking if I knew anyone in DC who was hiring. And I downloaded the resume, I looked, and lo and behold, the applicant went to Swarthmore. And I said, Daniel, yes, we are hiring. And Matt Heck, who's here today, is a junior programmer with us who, in true Swati fashion, was a political science major with a focus in ancient political theory, and also is incredible at brewing his own beer. Mm. So Matt, good to have you on the team. And we were talking recently, and he confirmed this notion that everybody, all 15 members of the Tech Change team, would have fit in well at Swarthmore. So it's not just that they're smart and they're hardworking, but it's also about a commitment and a passion for lifelong learning, for really taking on challenging new types of activities and approaching them with a mindset that they can do it. And so that's the first point. The second point is that community matters. And for us, community matters both in terms of the team we're trying to build internally and the online learning experiences we're trying to foster. There are lots of stereotypes that exist in the world around tech companies, that they're overwhelmingly men, that they're obsessed with making money. So in starting Tech Change, I was really excited about the opportunity to create a company from scratch, one that had at its center, at its core, this notion of community and social values. And early on in that process came across the B Corp process. Anybody know about B Corps here, a couple? Okay, so for those that don't, it's this external certification that says you're a company that cares just as much about social change as you do about profit. And you go through a very fairly rigorous review process in where you're assessed according to things like environmental stewardship, your social mission, and your organizational culture. We went through the process and became a B Corp. And the whole time, kind of always thinking back about Swarthmore as a community, as a model for a community where Quaker values and diversity are hardwired into the fabric of the place. Community is also important for us when we think about how do we create powerful online learning experiences. Before I started Tech Change, I took hundreds of online courses from all kinds of institutions. I enrolled in a nursing program at University of Phoenix, took courses at Coursera, edX, Khan Academy, Code Academy, Code School, Udacity, Udemy, you name it, I took it. And the question I kept coming back to in taking all these courses was, how do we take what works in a Swarthmore College seminar-style class and allow for that same kind of peer-to-peer interaction and social learning in a virtual environment? Not just for the purposes of providing powerful online learning, but also for the purposes of driving social change. An example, in our mHealth course that we do, we had a doctor from Colombia connecting with a healthcare worker in Uganda around how to a new strategy for getting patients to take their pills more effectively through the use of a cell phone. So those are the kinds of relationships we want to be able to foster. And the last thing I'll leave you with, because we're called Tech Change, I can't not speak about technology. So the third lesson learned is technology allows us to do so much But be careful not to get too caught up in the hype around technology. A little bit of a double-edged sword here. I built my first website at 16. It was terrible, and it took forever to build. But in the last 5 to 10 years, I would say that it's become so easy for organizations to leverage new tools and technologies to build organizations, be it through social media, or building a website, or just doing the basic accounting and HR practices that were typically done by people. So that's really exciting. It's become very easy. And beyond that, if we look more broadly around the world, 30% of folks can connect to the internet now, and 90% have access to cell phones. This has tremendous implications for bringing communities out of poverty and creating social change across the planet. But I say this all with a word of caution, because we like to say at Tech Change, if you're already headed in the wrong direction, technology will help you get there faster. In other words, technology is a magnifier of human intent. And that's why I think it really does become so critically important to focus on building the right communities, working with the right people, echoing a lot of the things we've heard on the panel today, even as technology becomes more accessible and ubiquitous in our time. So I'll stop there.
I think you'll agree with me that we have remarkable alumni on this panel and certainly in this room. And I did limit them time-wise, though they have much more to say. So what I wanted to do was to open the floor to you all to lift up those topics and issues you would like to hear them address more fully or maybe interactively. What do you want to hear more about? There's a quick hand in the corner over here.
Assume that all of you have suffered setbacks in your work of various magnitudes. Have you developed tools or techniques to quickly analyze a problem or your situation after a setback? And can you share with us?
So the question is about setbacks. Everyone has setbacks, and have you found ways of dealing with them quickly?
I mean, I can start. I mean, in my office, we joke around about how we're resilient losers. I mean, we lose, as doing civil rights litigation, you lose a lot of your cases, and you have to get used to that very quickly. But I think what we've learned is that, are always surprised when the first time we try something, it works. Because we take it for granted that we're going to have to try and approach a given problem in several different directions, sometimes sequentially and sometimes at the same time. But what I've really learned is that it's important to not let your ego get in the way of analyzing what you did well and what you didn't do too well, and figuring out. And again, I'm talking a lot in the context of litigation: why you lose a case, why you aren't able to get a piece of legislation enacted is another piece of my work. To gather your troops in to analyze what you did and what went wrong and what didn't, but then to bring outside people who aren't with your firm, but have enough familiarity with the issue area that you're working on to give you some concrete advice.
If I may add to that kind of analytical piece, I think there's also an attitudinal piece that has been a thread through all of our comments about patience. Change of any sort takes a really long time. And kind of related to that of understanding patience, I think Nick was talking about being a lifelong learner. And we learn the most when we fail. And if you can have that critical mindset, but I think you also have to have the attitude of, okay, this is gonna take a long time, particularly around social change, advocacy. It never happens overnight, because there are always forces opposed to the change. So I think the attitude is really important too.
And just to add real quick, we are starting to do something as a field in international development where we get together and hold fail fests, where people get up on stage and talk about their failure. And I think it ends up being a very fun, enjoyable experience, but it's also very powerful because there's so much pressure to not talk about failure, particularly from funding sources and donors, that if we can just create that space to begin with, not just within our organizations, but also within a community, then and really make it an experience, make it an event, and I think we're taking a good first step. So we've been involved in those. We wrote a song about our failure for one of these events, which is pretty funny, and you can watch it online.
That's great.
And if I could just add to that, one of the changes that I've seen in Swarthmore over the years is a real different change in attitude towards setbacks and failure, that the idea is to fail quickly. You try lots of different things, and you let it fail quickly, and then you try something else if it doesn't work, and without the stigma, or less stigma, attached to failure than there used to be. Another question. Back row.
Question about coworkers. To what extent are the people that, with whom you are working on your work, on your campaigns, on the things that you're engaged in, the people with whom you are together trying to find the far reaches of your ambition for your entire commitment to social change in your life's work, your view of how to do the big things that you want to do, to what extent have you found here at Swarthmore people with whom you then continue down the path that you set out on, not just on the job you're in, but where you're going to be? I'm assuming that all of you have made this commitment as a life's commitment, and that you recognize that you don't just make social change as individuals, you're making together with the people with whom you work. But is there a have you found the right people to throw in together on these the longer term where you're going or what you want, hope you're going more on?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that probably all of us feel like we could do things alone and we'll do them, but over time you start to develop this wonderful network and you realize that you really need these people. And so I've reached out to Patrick Ewa and Ruth Kwakwa, and I have 5 interns from Asheshi University in Ghana working with me starting next week. That's a wonderful collaboration, and again it happened over time, right? It didn't just we started the school with 24 people or something, and I started my school with 20 people, and it, it takes time to get to the point where, you can bring other people on board. And again, it's slow. None of this stuff happens overnight. But absolutely, I find his approach to, I've interviewed some of his students, his approach to teaching leadership and the idea of ethical education as a way to help change Ghana and the culture of corruption within the government is really critical. And so I think that working with people and people who are graduates of Swarthmore as well is really important, but I think we have to also be a less suspicious of power. And I think that you have a role as a leader to inspire people. You don't just assume that they have these credentials and therefore they get your project and they understand what you're doing and you set them off and then they go in a different direction, you get angry and you fire them. You really have to take the time to constantly inspire them to get everybody on the same path, because it's working together is difficult, and also sometimes you lose focus. What's the focus? What are we searching for? And so there is the importance of that leadership and the use of your own, in a sense, power, charisma to inspire people to stay with you in this kind of crazy, as my board of directors said, you're crazy, but a good crazy, he said to me.
I'd say change takes a community, and Swarthmore is a great community, and I mean by that we share values and experiences. All of us have other communities that we're plugged into. I'm especially fortunate because I have the Peace Corps community, and wherever people serve, wherever, whenever, I connect to them in the way that I look to the Swarthmore community. So you have to have communities of different sorts, but we're not the only community that's interested in social change.
I was just going to pick up on something Carolyn said about directing and helping people, because I what Kevin said earlier, I think of the social change as a very slow process. you know, I'll take as a caveat the Freedom to Marry movement, which just, I mean, is a case study in like, wow, talk about accelerated change from where they went. But most social change takes, lifetimes. And so you have to be a person who's a professional marathon runner. You have to run one marathon, take a break, and go on to the next. And I think of the people who do this work, a lot of them, you know, are highly educated and work for very little money and work, you know, very long hours. And I've thought a lot more as I've risen up in the ranks, so to speak, and have people reporting to me as opposed to me reporting to people, more about how to take care of people who do this work. My office instituted a fund, believe it or not. We set aside $10,000 a year, which is a big deal in a small nonprofit, but it's for basically things to take care of our group, to go out once in a while, to all go to the Barnes Foundation for the day for a trip, or to treat everyone to Thai food at lunch one time.
Good
that
choice.
We I know exactly. I knew you'd like that. But we really we have to remember that these are people who need to be nurtured and to be taken care of too, because they are doing incredible work. And sometimes, you know, you forget they're working 80 hours a week, and again, not seeing their family. So social change is also about nurturing the people.
Yeah.
No, not us. Maybe you check them out.
Okay.
I'm kind of curious if you think anyone on the panel, if this had kind of a lulling effect in the sense that, like, maybe technology is the answer, if only we sign another petition, if only there's betterchange.org, instead of, like, as opposed to actually gathering in public spaces and things of that nature.
Sure. Well, we're teaching a class on online learning, social media and social change that talks about this quite a bit. The whole phenomenon of slacktivism, the bar to be an activist is very low in the internet era. If all it takes is to click like or retweet someone's post, that's definitely real. I think we're seeing that in spades. I think a more interesting conversation is how do you pair the offline and online together? How do you use the online strategically to enhance the in-person? And that I think is having tremendous impact. We're in a growing campaign period here where we just haven't quite figured out the best model. But I do think there are lots of examples of. Certainly, we know more than ever before about the suffering of people thousands of miles away from us, and that would not have been possible without the internet, without these tools. So it's bringing us closer in new ways. It's also lowering that bar. I think we need to work extra harder to be able to foster those in-person connections through the use of technology.
I just wrote a piece called MOOCs and the Politics of Boredom.
Oh, interesting.
My concern, and I've been asked to write a longer piece, but my concern, because I actually am really interested in online learning, and even for the students in my school, is that there's a lot of offline learning that gets ignored as people build online, and as you said. And so I've been very slow to incorporate technology into my school. They go out, they build a wind turbine, right? That's what we put up, a wind turbine last summer. This summer we're creating all these water collection systems. So the students learn engineering and they go out and they do it, as opposed to kind of learning it online, mm-hmm. right? It's just there, it's changing their world physically. And then there's one of the 10 most polluted sites in all of the world, in Accra, which is an e-way dump site. So all of the technology that we celebrate, that we repurchase every 2 years, gets shipped and illegally dumped to this site, where then people are taking it apart and burning it, and destroying their health, and it's horrific. And so, there's an ethics to technology and engineering that I don't think that has, that needs to be part of a discipline, I think. Kind of thinking about this built-in obsolescence and what it's doing to the world around us. So I think there are other problems with technology besides just the, mm-hmm. what, slacktivism? I love that.
That's great terms.
We actually maybe have time for one more question.
Yes.
Carol.
Yeah, Carol.
Mm-hmm. I heard an NPR story that I'm hoping you may have heard about or know something about. Yeah, I think you might be somewhat well known. He has a tremendous critique of foreign aid in Africa. You know what I'm talking about? Good, and you'll be able to speak to it. Yeah. Who actually said that he said, and I'm sure there's an exaggeration, that virtually nothing to show for $3 trillion over a half century of aid to Africa, because it came in saying, we know what you need, and we will build that for you and do it for you, and he says, that does not work. That sounds like a fairly likely to be often true argument that we do come in thinking we know better. I mean, my sense of your experience, Carolyn, was that may have been an element there that you were saying more could have been done to start with on the ground to understand better what they needed and then provide stuff that they were invested in, because local people are not invested in it, it's going to fail. That was his main argument. And I'm curious, he also did a Peace Corps and said that if you talk to Peace Corps people privately, most of them will say their projects fail terribly. And I wonder if that's any truth to that or not. In general, if you think there's some truth to that argument.
Is that William Easter? This is William Easterly, the tyranny of experts.
Right.
I'm sorry?
White man's burden.
Yeah.
Sorry. White man's burden or the tyranny of experts by William Easterly. Is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Well, you know, first of all, I love these economists who are, you know, the Jeffrey Sachs on the one side and the Dambiso Moyos on the other side. What they're not saying is that you go to Accra and Accra looks profoundly different. You go to all of these urban sites, they look profoundly different. People live profoundly differently than they did 40 years ago. So I'm fascinated by the use of, again, numbers and statistics to claim a reality that actually isn't a reality at all. Mm-hmm. The world has changed drastically in sub-Saharan Africa. We can argue up and down whether it was aid or not, but we have to acknowledge that actually change happened. And that's my problem with that argument, that something happened. It may not have been what Americans wanted, but the Chinese are going in and they're making some real change, you know, and not based upon any kind of, arguments about the needs for whatever are sort of philosophical notions of freedom and which are all, anyway, it's complicated. And so, that's why I critique both the critiques, the economists' critiques of development, as well as the anthropologists' critiques of development, which is of course very true. You know, part of the problem is it's fly-by development, drive-by development, charity tourism. There are all of these kinds of critiques where people come in and they have a pet project. Women's education. We love the idea of women being educated, but men have to be educated too. You can't have a society, right? So how do you make those balances? And in communities, it matters that men are educated as well. So we have our kind of pet projects in the mirror. HIV/AIDS, fascinating. We have lower rates of HIV/AIDS in Ghana than we do in cities in the United States. And yet Gates comes in there and dumps a bunch of money towards HIV/AIDS prevention when in fact they're like, we really need, you know, we need this, not that. You know, so we have our, you know, ideas of what really matters, but on the ground people are saying, and this is why anthropologists matter. This is why liberal arts education matters. You know, we ask questions and they're like, well, you know, we do it because you come in here and say, we'll give you money to do it. Not because we think it's of any value, and so as soon as the money dries up, there's no commitment. And that's the problem. If money's driving the commitment, right? So I built a school because they asked me to build a school. They said, this is our commitment, right? So I wasn't certain after the initial issues I had with building the school, but I really pulled back. I mean, you mentioned a question about what do you do with failure? During the first year, I was having struggles with one of my teachers, and I pulled back. I slowed everything down, and I had to really study the commitment on the part of the community and the teachers, because I was willing to blow up my project if they claimed commitment that they didn't have. And what they did was they filled in the space that I left, which showed to me that they were truly committed. The fact that they, for about 6 months, they lived on basically nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I was starving the project to pull in forms of commitment. Once they showed that, I said, okay, I'm recommitting myself. But every year it's been that kind of, okay, you have to show me that this matters to you, because I'm not gonna move one inch until you show me that you are still committed to this project. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing kind of thing, but at this point, it's not even my school. You know, I mean, I come in there with Princeton students and Ashesi students, and my former students who's at Harvard Medical School. She's coming in with me, and we're helping to redesign the curriculum and standardize it and around a project-based STEAM curriculum. But this is all like because they're doing what they need to do on the ground. So it doesn't work. And so my focus in my book is on, we need to focus on engagement. Let's stop talking about development. Let's talk about engagement, because there's development going on around everywhere. In America, we're developing all the time. Go to a local school board meeting. Look at all the failure there, or a local, you know. Hey, any of you work in local politics? Oh my God, you know, talk about failure, right? So everyone's always developing. I think what we need to think about is how we engage with one another. Yeah, I agree with parts of his argument, but I think that kind of, you know, it's just too, anyway, whatever.
If I can just add briefly to Carolyn's point about the critique of development, there are certainly great, great arguments against it. But like all human endeavors, there have been some great successes and some abysmal failures. But I think one of the things we can do is put it in context. And when you talk about the $3 trillion down the toilet, I just remind us all that that's basically 4.5 years of the defense budget. And you know what says more about what we value than how we allocate our resources? So.
Last word from Lourdes or Nick?
Yep, it's been a great session.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you.